session number 27747, Real 7.
Pit, Real 7.
Well, then on the 22nd of July 1944, the Eastern Fleet sailed to bombard Sabang, which was quite a serious business. We were following the Nigeria, another cruiser, and I remember ahead of beyond the Nigeria, there was a sort of headland and little sparks of light coming up, and I thought, are those firing at me or are they firing at aircraft? But anyway, there was one water splash by the Nigeria, but you could never be quite sure of splashes, because it might have been a shell fired at the Nigeria, but it might have been the Nigeria made of balls of ramming her shells up and it had dropped short or something. But anyway, I was in the Admiral C cabin, which served as a cipher office, and I had a view, a scuttle, which gave me a view over the forecastle and A and B turrets, and I had a scuttle to the on the starboard side, so I could see what's happening on the starboard side. And our turrets were trained to starboard, and when they fired, although the deadlights were screwed down, or the scuttles were screwed down as far as I possibly could, you know, you still got the smell of cordite coming through. They were just, the detonation effect was tremendous. Mm. But anyway, there seemed to be nice lots of puff coming up from the shore. But the gunnery officer told me afterwards that after the first few rounds, there was so much dust that he really wasn't sure of the, you know, whether he was hitting the target or not. Anyway, that was all right. Now, we had known for some time that we were going to go to Durban to refit and, you know, have a bit of a change from the topics. But poor old Pitt was relieved by bloody paymaster midshipman. So I was put ashore. And on the 8th of August, I stood on the Maidan outside Colombo watching Ceylon sail away.
Oh.
And I was very sad about that, because she hadn't moved a foot without me hitherto. And, you know, She did, in fact, do another operation before she went to Durban, which I would have liked to have taken part in. But there we were. I have been appointed to the Hai Tan. But perhaps I could just talk a little bit about this ship. Our department was run by Paymaster Commander Cuffy Crump, who was a very nice chap. Navy through and through, but, you know, fatherly and the sort of chap to take a very raw officer in hand and, you know, bring him up the way he should go, quite kindly. So I remained friends with him until he died. He lived in St Albans. The captain had a bad stomach, and occasionally the poor old executive branch got it perhaps rather more than they should have done. But I always found him a fair man and had no difficulty. I didn't waste his time, he didn't waste mine.
What was his name?
Amory Parks. I think he had a relative who was quite a high official in the Automobile Association. Anyway, I think he went on to become King's Harbour Master of Portsmouth. I don't know what happened to him after that. But it was easier to be a paymaster than to be an executive officer, because, you know, paymastering involved sort of accounting, you know, clerical work, something that wasn't too remote from civil life. But the poor old executives who, you know, spent their time at a desk, then having to cope with manoeuvring a ship and manoeuvring boats and firing guns and, you know, range finding and all that sort of thing. It was a complete sea change for them, and much more difficult, and I think they did a jolly good job, actually. relations between the RN and the RNVR. It's touched on by Roskill a bit, but in a rather academic way. On the whole, we rubbed along pretty well together, but occasionally something would ruffle. And then, we would say the bloody RN and, the useless RNVR and so on, but it had all soothed down by and large, We got on very well with, I think, some degree of mutual respect. But of course, I don't know if I've said this before, that some of the, at least two of the branches were entirely RNVR and his hostility only, because radar had come in since the war started. And all the radar officers I knew were RNVR. I'm not quite sure what happened to the radar after the war. I think it must have been taken over by the electrical branch, but I'm not sure of that. And another speciality, which again was RNVR, was fighter direction, which was a new thing. Again, what happened after the war, I don't know. Mm-hmm. Well, now, 8th of August found me, as I say, on Colombo, Maidan, and I had been appointed as a second accountant officer, which was a step up in a way, to the Haitan. Now, what I'm going to say about her is largely in an article called Fred Carnot's Navy, in autumn, published in Warship World in autumn 1992, corrected in one minor point by an issue in autumn 1996. The Haitan only does figure in one or two, in one book of reference, College, but most people ignore her. And the one who doesn't ignore her, which is John Winton's The Forgotten Fleet, even describes her wrongly, but he's the only one that mentions at all, so it's better to be misdescribed than not described at all, I suppose. She was built by the Germans, Schickschau in Danzig, in 1908, and as I believe, a cadet ship for the Imperial Russian Navy. Then somehow or other, she became the SS Sylvia, which served as a honeymoon liner on the New York Bermuda run. After that, she fell on bad days and descended to the dregs of the merchant shipping, namely the China coast, where she was taken over by a company which owned a coal mine. So in a retrograde step, they converted her from oil fuel to coal burning, which had consequences. Anyway, in 1941, she was taken over by the Navy and became a base ship at Adu Atoll, which, as I said, I mentioned before. And then in August 44, she came up and was anchored in Colombo, where I joined her. She was 3,554 tons. I don't know what her shaft horsepower was. With the wind behind her, she could get up to 9 knots. Against the wind, it was about 7. And she had an armament of, I think, 6 Oerlikons in bandstands and a couple of machine guns. But after the Salon, which was a crack modern cruiser, the sort of rust bucket was a complete culture change. Yes. I felt I'd rather come down in the world to tell you the truth. But there we were. Now, the idea was that we should be a base ship in the Pork Strait, which I had mentioned before. And this was an idea of the people at Kandy under the eagle eye of Lord Louis Mountbatten. And, of course, what they had completely overlooked was that, A, we couldn't distill our own water, which normal ships in the Navy normally could, and, B, we were a coal burner. You know, the ignorance of Kandy gave you one no confidence in the planners there at all. The paymaster and I went up by train to Jaffna, which, of course, is now the centre of Tamil insurrection against the Sinhalese government. But it was under the British Raj, of course, all was well and quiet. And it was quite evident that you couldn't get a water boat alongside in Jaffna, even if you could get the water. So that kiboshed that. The other thing was that if we coal, there was coal available in Colombo. So if we coal shipped in Colombo, through the galley, of course, that was the, you know, health and safety, we steamed round to the Port Strait. By the time we got there, it was, if we weren't cold, we'd have to come back again. So, anyway, they soon realised that, by and large, we weren't pretty good for that. Meanwhile, my duties were enlarged because I was not only looking after cash, etc., but I was also looking after stores. And I said stores were indeed a problem. There was an engineer officer who was wanting stores, and I used to indent on the store people ashore using the forms provided for the purpose, and sat back and waited for the stores to come. Bugger all happened. So under his acid tongue, I began to be rather more active, and I used to get a 3-ton lorry and go down to the store place and take what I wanted and sign for it and come back again, because that was the only way to do it.
Yes.
But in that way we got by. But then they decided to convert us into a landing ship headquarters.
Before you go on to that, what sort of things were you buying at the stores?
Can't remember now. There'd be spare valves and things like that, electric light bulbs, all the rest of it. We had to set up our own naval stores because we on board the ship, because we hadn't had one before. But naval stores were divided into two, really. There's what they call consumables, which were things like light bulbs and minor electrical equipment, and permanent, where by and large they couldn't be used to destruction. And there the chap in charge of the department had to sign for them, and when he left he had to transfer responsibility for them to his successor. And when you paid off, they had to be returned to naval stores. I'm sorry, I can't think of anything. Vowels, what else?
It gives me the general idea.
My responsibilities, incidentally, did not include food. The victualling was always under the control of the paymaster commander, and he was very welcome to it. Now then, the idea that we of sending us to the Port Strait was to have someone there, presumably with stores and such like available, and deep draft tankers were going to transship their oil into shallow draft tankers, which would go up to Calcutta. God knows what they did in Calcutta, but there we are. And also they needed to establish a landing craft base where the landing crafts could form and exercise, ready for the invasion of Malaysia, which would have been an absolutely bloody business if this had come, had to be implemented. I've talked about the store shortage, but when they decided to make us a landing ship headquarters, they gave us what they called a planned pack, which was the first time I come across this. Plan pack was for a 10,000 ton cruiser with all her consumables for 3 months. So we were, when we got that on board, we were all right. Well, then I think while we were there, I did have a leave on a tea plantation, a place called Tillicoultry, which I believe is a nice Scots name, I don't know, and saw the little ladies picking the tea leaves off the tea plants, and went into the tea factory where, as I recollect, the tea went through a lot of revolving cylinders, and the smaller the mesh, the worse the tea. So, you know, when you got to the very last charge, as it were, the, you know, it was pure dust. But that was very interesting, and the The people who ran it were very kind to us. Well, then we went up to Bombay, and we installed lots of extra wireless sets for our new jobs, and the Army and the RAF came on board. Now, I should have explained that in Colombo, the crew had been what they call T-124 ratings, who were Merchant Navy ratings, embarked really in what you might call fleet auxiliaries, but not for warlike purposes. And we had Guyanese stewards who were very good, very economical. The Warden Mess was always had a hefty credit when they were running, and they all had very similar names. You know, if you were Bello Pinto or Sequeira or Mascarina, someone would come, even if not quite the one you would expect. The deck crew and the engine room crew were Lascars, and I had to get used with dealing with the Serang, who was the sort of chief bosun, the chief bosun's mate, and there were...
He was called the Serang.
Serang, yes. And what else now? I wrote this down because I wanted to try and remember it. There were Bandaris, which were cooks, Sikanis, who I think were quartermasters, and so on.
So these were all different ethnic groups from different...
Oh, well, the Muslims, as far as I'm aware. Oh, I suppose they could have been... the bloody crew. The Guyanese were Catholic, Portuguese,
yes.
From Guyanese. They were Portuguese. I never remember anybody prostrating themselves to Mecca, so I suppose they must have been Hindu.
Mm.
I think they came from near Bombay. But, of course, nothing in the East is quite straightforward. The Serang would be the head man in a leading light in the village, and he would pick villagers to go with him in return, of course, for a cut of their wages. And occasionally he used to wheel in some individual who wanted to make an allotment to his wife, and the address would be pavement outside, you know, the Grand Oriental Hotel Bombay. But anyway, the money seemed to get through. And of course they were on a different sort of diet altogether, and I wasn't concerned with that, but you know, ghee for butter and dal with pulses and so on. Well, all went well with this lot until we got to Bombay, but when they saw the Army and the RAF coming on board, they realised that there was a question of going to war. Please, sir, that wasn't what we signed for. So when the time came to put to sea, they mutinied.
Oh.
Yes.
Oh, dear.
Yes, indeed. So the Pay and I descended into the galley and started making soup, and the ship proceeded to sea, and the captain made the classic signal, crew mutinous and proceeding to sea with the aid of the Army and the RAF.
But so anyway, how were they mutinying?
Well, they just sat down and would do nothing. There was no violence, none at all. Anyway, as soon as we got to sea, thank God, they came back to duty. But when we got to Colombo, we were met by a motor fishing vessel with the 40 Marines on board, each armed with submachine guns, you know. Because you couldn't break wireless silence, you see. So no one knew the state of the ship until we got to Colombo.
Was that quite frightening?
What, the mutiny?
Yes.
Well, I slept with a double-ended spanner under my pillow, but they were fairly decent sort of clothes, I would have thought. But anyway, when we got to Colombo, of course, that was quite an affair, because discipline had to be maintained. So that's where my legal experience came in useful, because I was able to con the Admiralty Memorandum on court-martial procedure and draft charges. Actually, mutiny wasn't too well covered, or so I thought. And the chief butler, who was the sort of Goanese chief petty officer in charge of the Goanese, he wouldn't have anything to do with the mutinous assembly on the forecastle, and retired to his bunk. So what the hell do you charge the chief butler with? Did I distinguish myself? I said, did fail to take his make his utmost... But then did fail to use his utmost endeavours to suppress a mutinous assembly on the forecastle, they should less right hand.
How many people were gathered on the forecastle?
Oh, I should think there'd be about 40 or 50. But anyway, I suppose they all came before the captain. They all weighed off with about 28 DQs. And, of course, dismissal from the service, which was exactly what they wanted. So, up till then, we had had... the supply broth, well, the stores assistants, the writers, and the signal to Lake Rivers were all white. But now, of course, we have white men on board. We got the dregs of the fleet, because, you know, stokers wouldn't take kindly to shuffling coal. No. But anyway, that was all right.
And were the mutinous put off at Colombo?
Yes. Thereafter, we sailed for Calcutta. I remember we took some wardrobes up for some club there, which were called Almira's. When we got to Calcutta, we had a problem with the forecastle. The details of that tend to vary depending whom you listen to. We had to go alongside in dock for repair by Chinese fitters. Be absolutely racist. The Chinese were slightly superior in what they could achieve to some most of the Indians, and you know they were all right. When I was ashore, I'd go to a Chinese restaurant for bacon and eggs, but I would never go to an Indian one. I never said that. Then we set sail for the Burma coast. And I remember taking a message up to the captain, who was sunning himself on the bridge in a deck chair with General Christensen, who was commanding the 15th Division, with whom we were going to be involved. We landed, we put in at Ram Ree, and there I saw for the first time a memorial which had those words on, which have become famous since. And I found rather moving, actually, at that time. It was, when you go home, tell them of us, and say for their tomorrows, we gave our todays. I think I say plural, but I don't know that that's necessarily right.
But, who wrote that, do you know?
Yes, there was some correspondence in the Times about it the other day, and I can look it up for you with a bit of luck. I was not a religious bloke at all, but I did have one thing that stuck in my memory, and that was when we were going from Fremantle, this was going back in the Ceylon, the Fremantle to Colombo, which was about 10 days steaming at 14 knots. And I remember going from the boardroom and up at the back of the bridge superstructure and just sort of hanging over the rail and looking at the ship rolling very slightly. And, you know, there was tossing water right the way round. It was night time. And one realised how small and insignificant the human being was, and I thought, well, I suppose we're in God's hands, and you know, felt oddly rather comforting. But anyway, I mentioned that for what it's worth. Well, from Ram Ree we went on to Letpan, which was the scene of action. We went up a chong, which was a sort of creek, if you like, with palm trees and undergrowth on both sides. Yes. Excellent cover for snipers. But in the idea, the Japanese were retreating along the coast road, and the idea was to intercept them and presumably kill a few of them, the little bastards. But happily, they'd all gone. So it was a complete success.
There was
no trouble.
Yes.
But I was in the cipher office and I really didn't see much of it. I shared it with army cipher people, had a quick look at what they were up to and decided they were more cumbersome than us, but then maybe I'd go into it. It was quite interesting because we were supported by a tribal class destroyer, which was a very strong one, and a sloop of some power, and that was all. But of course the Japanese fleet couldn't intervene because the Eastern Fleet by that time was too strong for it, but we had local control by virtue of just these two ships. We could move wherever we wanted to, and
yes,
the Japanese couldn't,
yes,
which is a demonstration of sea power.
Yes,
then we went across to Madras and we were tied up there. And an ammunition ship across the harbour caught fire. We all sweated and ran out to the fire hose and hoped the best. But it was rather more serious at that time than it might seem now. But the previous December, an ammunition ship had blown up in Bombay and had done an awful lot of damage. I don't think that's very well known, but we were a bit frightened.
Yeah.
But anyway, fortunately, the fire was put out. Then we sailed out from Madras towards Trinco, and we had a crass mechanician who contrived to let the water out of the boilers, which, of course, that's another way of blowing up. Anyway, we prowled uneasily over the upper deck. But anyway, we got the water back in, and we got to Trinco all right. And this was a very miserable period of my life, believe it or not, because we tied up in Trinco. It was obvious that there was no future for us as a headquarters ship because all the proper... We were a makeshift job, whereas all the proper headquarters vessels like the Largs and the Bulolo, who had done the D-Day and the Operation Dragoon in the south of France, were coming out. I mean, they were much better equipped than we.
So they were just starting to come out?
Yes. So we were underemployed and we had nothing to do, and everybody got rather miserable and bad-tempered and nothing to distract us. There were spats between the officers and all the rest of it. But anyway, we went round to Bombay to pay off, and there was VJ Day, I think.
How long were you in the previous port,
in Trincomalee? Oh, I don't know, about a couple of months, I would guess. Yes. But
quite a time, really, feeling bored and away from home.
Exactly, exactly. But we went round to Bombay. Now, I think we were there for VJ Day, but of course we had the news of VE Day with mixed feelings. Delight that the Germans had been clobbered, delight that our relatives were safe from V1s, V2s. But at the same time, you know, we saw people dancing in the streets in the East End and so on. And the war, as far as they were concerned, the war was over, but it bloody well wasn't. My friend Peter, my friend Peter wrote to me and said, I see that they're discussing the form the war memorial should take. Don't they realise that all the applications aren't yet in? You know, and I've got the letter somewhere in which he said that. But anyway, the VJ Day came. Now, I'm going to be controversial here, but this is what I deeply feel, that, you know, a lot of the bleeding hearts say that dropping the atom bombs on Hiroshima and Nagasaki was immoral. But the Japanese were an absolutely dedicated warlike race who would have fought to the last inch for their emperor, and whether they were winning or whether they were losing. And if it had been necessary to invade Malaysia from Ceylon, it would have been an absolute bloodbath. it's a pity in a way that people had to die, but I think, you know, the bleeding heart should ask themselves, would they rather lose Japanese, who after all had started it all, than perhaps their grandfathers and fathers? But, you know, they don't seem to think about that. I hope I haven't upset you, but that's what I feel. Yes, we did. We fired some celebratory pyrotechnics in Bombay. Near the end, are we?
I think probably.
Mm-hmm.